Hello, welcome to the keynote conversation with myself and Lamour. I'm Phil Terone, senior editor of Make Magazine and contributing editor to Popular Science. And I like to make things. Yes.
My name is Lamour Freed. I'm a recent graduate of MIT, the MIT Media Lab, and I'm really into hardware and building stuff and engineering, electronics. And what I've been working on lately is open source hardware and how, you know, we can take this paradigm of open source software and make it physical things out of it.
So if we could switch to the computer on the overhead here. A lot of people make weird things. Over the last couple years, we like to keep a pulse on what's happening. You've been making bizarre stuff, and we'll show some of that in a bit. This is a fellow named Carrie, and he makes the monocycle. It's a motorcycle with one wheel, and to make it balance, he actually fills the bottom with molten lava.
Yeah, this is sort of like a biker Segway. I kind of like it.
Yeah, I've seen the Segways. This is like the badass version. This is, we always talk about alarm clocks, and you have something that you're working on later that's going to maybe help wake people up, but this is an interesting one. It's the bacon alarm clock.
Yeah, I'm Jewish, so I asked him to maybe make a pastrami on rye clock.
Yeah.
So when you wake up, you get that pickle.
So
bacon.
For the folks who like to wake up in the morning with, you know, the smell of fresh cooked breakfast, yeah, this warms up bacon. So, good stuff. The, one of my favorite makers that we're friends with, his name is Mikey Sklar, and he made this vest so he can go out in the desert and kind of cool off, and it's a vest made out of old PC fans.
Yeah. It's funny because when he walks around, people ask him, does that really work? And he says, why would I be wearing a shirt made out of PC fans if fans didn't work? I love it. He's a great guy.
Didn't work. Yeah. This is the same fellow that put an RFID tag in his hand and then proceeded to make a trampoline that you can only operate if you had the right RFID tag because it has flames in it. So when you bounce up and down, flames shoot out.
Well, you don't want, like, random people coming up and using your flamethrower trampoline.
Yeah.
You want authorized only access. So.
So
he had an RFID tag embedded in his hand, so it's a still bet. Yeah.
This is one of the more recent ones that someone sent me. This is the gummy bear chandelier made out of thousands of gummy bears. And the neat thing about this is the artist, her name's Yaya Chow, she said after 2 years you can still eat it because it's still fresh.
Well, of course that implies that she was eating the chandelier after 2 years. Also, you know, hungry, just reach up, grab this.
But it's interesting that gummy bears, you know, last that long. That's kind of messed up. Maybe you shouldn't eat them. Then some of the projects that we see and some of the things that we're interested in don't immediately have a use, you think. But when you think about it, they do. This is from the AVR concept. AVR is a type of chip. And this little device is someone they made. They released the source code and the schematic. And this measures when dogs actually have seizures. And
it's in the corner.
That's Princess in the corner.
That's a problem.
And he had a problem where he needed to measure the seizures so he could give the information to his vet. But he didn't really have a way to do it, so he built his own device and then released the schematic from the source, and he won a contest for it. This is a DIY laptop. It's not the latest Dell. It's actually it's one of the type of projects that we see where people are taking old technology and cobbling it together and turning it into something that's sort of new, but homemade.
It kind of reminds me of the old Apple laptops, like the lead acid battery. It weighed like 20 pounds, like the first Apple laptop. That was good. You know, so. PowerBooks are next, I guess.
This is another fun one. So at NYU's ITP, where you just sat recently viewing and talk about this stuff, they have a plant project that uses an Arduino board, an open source project, and it uses Asterix, which is the voicemail telephony system. And these plants will actually call you when they need water, and they're pissed. They're like
water me already.
Yeah, they're like,
you don't water.
I can't go out and water myself, so please water me.
So we enable plant and dogs and people, the whole spectrum.
So these wacky projects, you know, there's always something that kind of binds them together. Oh, this is the Death Star subwoofer. This is whatever, it's like, if you want a subwoofer, you want it to be the Death Star. So what these projects have in common is people are sharing the recipes, people are doing different things once they have the schematics and the source code, and it's starting to fall under this category, which is pretty much all the work that you do, which is open source hardware, which is being defined, and how do you define it?
Well, I think it's interesting that we have, you know, these tinkerers, and I think Make Magazine celebrates these people who build crazy stuff, and technology actually, because of the web, it's easier than ever to build your own technology. And once you've got this mass of tinkerers and electronics enthusiasts, well, that kind of harkens back to, you know, pre-open source software days, with a lot of people who were computer enthusiasts, these old hackers, and then they sort of banded together and created this sort of movement called the open source software movement. And so I sort of see a parallel here where I think it would be very interesting if people started this open hardware movement. Instead of just tinkering, they actually released things under open source hardware licenses. And a lot of people say, okay, well, what do you mean specifically by open source hardware? And so I just want to define exactly what I mean, because software, we know you release the source code. So what is hardware? Well, there's many levels of what hardware means. I'm in electronics, so this is very electronics-based. But at the very low level, there is mechanics. You know, the case. How big is the case? Where do you drill the holes to put in all the buttons and knobs? So you can release that kind of information in a DXF file or other open interchange format and release it under Creative Commons license.
Some people are using like SketchUp to make the physical, the 3D models of things.
So it used to be CAD software was extremely expensive, thousands of dollars, but now there's SketchUp, which Google just bought, and now there's a free version, and there's a Libre, and there's, you know, a free version of that. So hopefully more people will be doing more open source CAD design. That'll be a computer-aided design. Yeah. And then the next level above that is circuit board design. So you have to have the data for how to design a circuit board that forms the substrate. And there's open formats for that, Gerber files, or you can release the actual ProTel files and release that under Creative Commons. So all of my projects, I release the schematics and board layout files under these open licenses.
So when you release your projects for under Creative Commons, what type of licensing do you do? Like, you can share it and sell it, or share it and not sell it? How do you? Because there's not a lot of hardware under Creative Commons.
Well, I go with Creative Commons just because it's easy to kind of make your own license. And so I went with attribute, share alike, but not the non-commercial. So you can actually use it for commercial projects and stuff.
Someone can take your stuff, and we'll show some of it in a bit, but they can take your things and make a commercial product for it.
Yeah,
that's okay.
That I don't care about.
You don't care.
But I think that attribution is good, because I think having a URL in the project is useful, not even because I want credit, but because documentation is there and more information is there, because with software, it comes on a diskette. It's easy to put manuals on that diskette, but with hardware, it's like boxed, where, you know, the manual may not come with it. And then above that, there is firmware. So that's the software that runs on the microcomputer inside the device. And so we'll have an example of that. And so you can release that at C or assembly or BASIC or other programming languages. So that's starting to get more into the software that we know. You know, it's available as a text file. So you can release that under GPL or BSD, and a lot of people do that. And then another, you know, on the side is, as well as releasing all the information of the schematics, you also want to release data sheets and parts lists. Like, where do you get these parts? You can physically build these devices. Some data sheets are only available with NDAs, and so I say maybe you should be using those.
Is that the hardest part, like finding the parts? I know when we do projects, like everyone's like, my Radio Shack doesn't have parts. Like,
yeah.
So even just knowing where to find them is...
Because there's no standard way of getting parts, that's actually a hard documentation problem. And Radio Shack doesn't carry a lot of stuff, and they're actually about to stop carrying all electronic components, I think, pretty soon. So it's useful to have, you know, as much information as possible about how to get these parts and make sure that you can get them easily, especially in the U.S. or Canada or Europe. So that's not a solved problem, but, you know, work as hard as you can to document that. And then on top of firmware, there's software and APIs. And so now we're getting into, you know, familiar territory, opening up the API for a physical device. We'll have an example of what that means.
Yeah. And so some of the firmware projects and some of the other projects are not ideal. They don't fall under the strict definition of an open source hardware project, but there's little bits and pieces that are starting to come out. Like, if we could switch to the computer, the W54G project.
Yeah, this is like a perfect example of, well, again, because there's many layers, there's mechanics and the parts list, and just Gerber files. You know, there's very few projects that are completely open source from beginning to end. Unlike software, there's so many different components. But even having one component be open is often a boon to people who want to experiment. So a lot of people have heard of this Linksys router. The firmware inside the router is Linux-based. And so a lot of people would take these routers and they load new firmware onto it. And there's, you know, lots of forums and web pages and resources. And there's step-by-step instructions on how you can turn this $75 router into something that has $500, $600 router capabilities. And that's so powerful. And they've actually moved to VxWorks, which is a closed firmware subsystem. But they maintain this other line, the GL line, which is always available. It's a little more expensive, but it's available for people who want to tinker. So I think people spoke, and the market responded, yes, we're going to have this available.
And so has anyone ever modded a router and, like, little clapping, little router? Yeah. Because the router modded in the house.
I mean, you couldn't do that before, and so wouldn't it be neat if we could extend that to more devices? And that's a very nice example.
And then the next one, if we get to the computer again, you know, the Roomba is kind of a...
So the nice thing about the Roomba, it's interesting, they didn't release the firmware, they didn't release the technology in the, that they have inside the Roomba, and they didn't release the schematics or parts list, but they did open up the API, and hardware API means they literally have a little, you know, a little door that you open up, and there's a socket, and you can plug in, and you can see this fellow plug in some electronics, and he turned this into a robot platform, and it does something interesting or special. And I actually don't remember what this project does, but opening up this API so that people can turn this vacuum into a robotics platform, and that kind of that actually became, I think, much more popular than iRobot expected.
Yeah.
And so they created a new product called the Create, which they just released at CES, and it's an educational robotics platform, and it builds on this. It actually took away the vacuum part and made it just a robotics platform.
Yeah,
and people could just do this.
It's interesting because if you do robotic, the hardest thing is getting it to move, the locomotion. And then by the time you're done with it, you're bored. It's like, oh, I can make my robot move, and now I don't really care about the smarts. And so they opened up the locomotion part, so you can move it around, you can do different things. And some of the projects we've seen already is someone mounted a hamster ball on top of it, so a little hamster runs around, and the robot runs around. And I've heard a weird project about traffic or something once in Frogger. But there's a lot of things that people are doing, and that led to the educational bot, which is interesting. So there was enough momentum, and it's neat because if you think about it, it's really challenging for a company, a publicly held company, they release a way for you can control this vacuum. And their worst nightmare would be like, you know, grandma gets pushed down the stairs because robots want to do that. So, but they do it, and the robots try to, but what's interesting is they went ahead and did it, and it worked out great, and now there's a new product, and there's a really big community behind it, just because this little tiny opening, so we'll see what happens next. And then if we go back to the computer, the green phone, that's another one.
Yeah, so this is not quite released yet. I think it's still in beta, but this is, if people haven't heard of this, is a phone that is running Linux. It's running, ARM Core with sort of small Linux firmware on top of it, sort of like the router. And again, it's open, and they have this software development platform openly and available, so people can write their own apps for their phone. And this doesn't sound, you know, very complicated, but a lot of phones, you can't do that. I know that you had a Sidekick 3, and you were frustrated that there wasn't a terminal program available for it.
Yeah, it was just a couple days late, but eventually I got one. But one of the interesting things is, you can develop cell phone apps, and maybe you can go to carriers and get them, you know, certified. You can, if it's a Windows mobile phone, you can develop apps and kind of deploy it on your own. But one of the interesting things is you can't get into the phone itself. Like, it took how many years to get visual voicemail? Like, everyone's freaking out about the iPhone, but you really couldn't make your own voicemail program to do visual voicemail. So with something like the Linux phone and the way they opened up, you could probably dig in and get to the way the phone works with voicemail a little bit better.
Usually they have a very thin API that they give you access to, but with this Linux phone, you have access all the way down to, you know, the device driver. So you can really develop hardcore applications that do exactly what you want. And so as long as there's one developer out there who wants visual voicemail, he'll write the application and release it, and, you know, you can upload it.
Otherwise, we just have to wait until, like, Apple tells us, you know.
And if they decide that there's no market for it, or, you know, it gets discontinued, that's it. So.
One of the other ones, if you could go to the computer again, is the ambient orb. Has any of you guys seen the glowy orb that tells you, like, stocks and all that?
So it's like you can program it to tell you about the weather or your stocks or, you know, all, like, sports information, I guess. Yeah. And what's interesting is they didn't open source a lot of the information, but they did release everything. And that's actually pretty interesting because I've never seen a company release schematics for their products. But this is one of the schematics example. And they actually say, you should go and build your own ambient orb and send us pictures and tell us about it and add more functionality. And they actually had a, they have a web page with all the parts list and where to buy them and about how much it costs. And that's, even though it's still copyright ambient devices, it's a good start. You know, again, intellectual property is always a difficult point for companies, but even releasing this information is a step in the right direction towards empowering the user.
And then one of my favorites, because there's always like tension between companies and users, and some people want to do things with their technology, and companies aren't quite sure yet. The iPod Links project, that was one where people really did a lot of hacking, putting the iPod into an actual like sound chamber so you can hear it boot up so they can figure out exactly what code to write so they can put a boot driver on it to get it into Linux.
Well, I think it's interesting because, again, the Linux, you know, the iPod Linux firmware project, I mean, it took a lot of effort. And, again, there's these weird stories of, like, how they figured it out, sort of lockpicking style, reverse engineered how to do it. And I think that's cool, but it would have been nice if instead of having to go through all this effort, like, how do you, you know, how can we do this if they had just made it easy to put Linux on there? So whether or not, whether companies release this information or not, it will eventually be reverse engineered if the product is distributed widely enough. I just think that it would have been nice if they'd made it more easy for the developers. They could go on and develop the app instead of wasting all their time to reverse engineering the firmware.
Well, there was the PlayStation Portable, which is a neat example, where there was a constant arms race between Sony and all the people who wanted to run their own programs because there really wasn't an easy way to do that. So every week there was... Did anyone run Homebrew on a PSP? Maybe a couple little clappy?
No.
Like five of you? Yeah, all five of you. So, you know, but you really want to do that. You buy this device and you want to run, like, MAME or other apps, and Sony would keep changing it. And then there was the disposable digital cameras that they're $20, but people figured out ways to mod the firmware. And at first, the company's like, oh, you know, this isn't a big deal. We really don't care. And then they noticed all the efforts going into it, and then they kept changing the firmware. But what happened was there was projects like putting inside of a rocket and launching it up and recording stuff, putting inside of a helmet, making night vision goggles. There's like 50 projects that you can do with this $20 disposable camera, all because of this reverse engineering that was done by a few people. So they were able to get the information out and do all sorts of things. And what great projects happened because of that. You know, what interesting science fair things that we saw that came out, all because of some reverse engineering. So now, with your stuff that you do, you have kits. You release all of them under open source licensing or Creative Commons licensing. And you also use a lot of the web technologies that people are talking about everywhere in this conference. And
yeah, I think it's actually interesting because you know, some people ask me, well, you do electronics. What are you doing at this very, you know, web software-oriented, media-oriented conference? And what the great thing about web is the web and all these Web 2.0 technologies is how you can use them to sort of document and advertise and distribute information about hardware. I think that documentation is really important, and that's one of sort of the killer apps of open source hardware is without enough documentation, it's difficult to distribute this information. Without web technology, it's difficult to distribute this sort of information. So I really like to pick and choose of all the, you know, the new and exciting technologies out there and use them in a hardware infrastructure.
And so if you go to the computer, one of the projects that we just worked on together was a laser etching company. So we have this big $20,000 laser, and people bring their laptops in and their iPods, and we basically Voyager warranty and put under the laser. And here's the iPod. Here's a Portuguese flag. Here's a Mac about to get lasered. Here's shuffles. Here's all sorts of different things that we laser etch. This is on a Dell. This is the caution thing with the fingers getting chopped off. About a year ago, I bought a PowerBook, and I decided it'd be a really good idea to put a gigantic, creepy little Tarsier on it from O'Reilly. And it's neat because when you go through the airport, they've never seen this before, and they don't really know how to react. They're like, is that, but why do you have, is that the devil? So it's usually what happens. So And, you know, when you have a laser, everything, like, what's the phrase? You have a hammer, everything looks like nail. When you have a laser, everything starts looking laserable. So we laser etched this instructions on how to make sushi on the nori, because that was fun. So, you know, you're like, oh, I can know how to make it. It's on the back. I think it's a good idea. And, you know, just a variety of devices. We get a lot, we're in New York, and we get a lot of people emailing us. There's a monk, he's like, I really want to laser etch my own sign. We're like, all right, cool, monk, you know, come on in. We wanted to do kung fu and, like, fight to death, but it didn't work out. We asked for $30. Someone had a gun, and they were like, I want to etch my Glock. And we said, okay, and so they brought in the cartridge. But one of the interesting things is we don't really want to do this for a living. We decided we'll get the laser, we'll open the business process, we'll give away all the templates, we'll tell everyone how to do it, and because we're lazy and we didn't want to update pages a lot, we actually have wikis. So what we do, and let me try to find the wiki. It's one of these. We have a wiki on every piece of equipment. So there's the laser itself. You need a filter system. If you cut plastic, there's fumes that pour out. Not good to breathe. HEPA filters, all the accessories that you need. We went through and basically just documented everything we could if you needed to start your own laser business. And we put it under, like, a there wasn't even a license that we did.
Yeah.
We just said, like, go.
It's a public domain.
Go and do it. If you know, everyone here has probably been in the interactive world forever. When CD-ROM burners came out, they were like, thousands of dollars, and eventually they got cheaper. When printers came out, they were thousands of dollars, and they got cheaper. So what we're trying to do, and it looks like it's working out, is the more we give away this information, the more people buy these lasers. And like eventually, most of us will probably have something that does something like a laser cutter in our homes. It might right now.
There's 10,000 version of a laser cutter.
Yeah, it'll cut things out. It'll etch things.
You get cartridges for it.
We think that we think if we keep doing this, more people will buy them. The prices are already starting to go down a little bit. And
well,
people are starting businesses.
Yeah, what's interesting is that, you know, again, sort of this information is available and people go to this wiki and actually people are trying, like, it's only been up for like 4 days. They've already gotten like 20 edits and people are actually adding pretty useful information. And, you know, they bought a different kind of filter and how did that work out? And so they're sharing this information. There's a forum. So, you know, I tried to make it not look like a wiki. It's actually sort of embedded.
Wikis look awful. That's the main problem.
Wikis look awful. But, you know, if you can embed it and make it look like a web page so it's more useful for people, because the 99% of people don't edit it. But hopefully, you know, getting this hardware information out there, more people will buy this technology and use this technology.
And for folks who follow, like, there's something called, quote, Fab Lab, and it's a way to build different pieces of equipment or to have different pieces of equipment that will make things. So you could go in with a diagram and then you get a part.
Well, you get these open source DXFs, you download them, and then you press the print button, and literally a laser cutter is like a printer. There's a printer driver in CorelDRAW. You press the button. So it'd be neat, you know, people start getting laser cutters, they become more available, people actually start exchanging and sharing information on, you know, here's a, you know, cat toy you can make with your laser cutter or something, you know, ridiculous, and you press the button and you print it out. So.
And for the most part, we're probably, the laser cutter's probably almost paid off. We're getting closer.
Pretty close.
So, you know, if anyone wants to start a laser cutter business, there's one in Oakland that just opened up, and they're going under the same open format that we are, and they're giving away all their templates.
Yeah, so if you use our information, we say, you know, sort of a share-alike type. I mean, you can't, of course, put a license on information like this. You know, we don't want to copyright it, really, because we want people to, you know, share it, print it out, and it's, you know, licenses don't apply as well, but we do want people to give back, and so having something like a wiki and a forum is really good, so we can create this, you know, how-to manual for a business that does open-source hardware.
And so that's wiki, and someone already posted PVC, big no-no material with this laser. Fumes from the PVC are toxic, and the filter won't help. Okay, good note.
Yeah.
So someone edited that. No more PVC press. So the other thing so that was wiki. Now let's move on to podcasting.
Okay.
So you use, you're a podcaster now, oddly enough.
I'm a podcaster. I don't know how that happened. Well, so I thought that, you know, I sort of didn't understand why I would want to use a podcast, but then, you know, one of the, kits that I sell is a synthesizer, which is right here.
Yeah. So before you start, so that is an open source hardware project. And it is a clone of a Roland 303. Are there any musicians here that know what a Roland 303 is? Does it? Yeah, look at all those musicians. Holy crap. So it's a good thing.
So, I mean, the thing is that people, I don't really do music, so it's kind of interesting coming at it with almost no information background. And I think one of the things that musicians really want to see is they want to hear it in a track. They want to see what it can do or hear what it can do.
Oh, can you play a little thing on it? I'm going to unplug it.
Well, we can. The walk-in music was actually tracks from the podcast. So kind of funky sound.
So you designed this, but you're not a musician at all, huh?
No.
I couldn't tell from that. I thought it was that.
I know. Junk cake. So,
let's see. All right.
So, we have
the
podcast, but the podcast actually, there's no speaking on it. It's all people sharing their tracks and uploading tracks, and, you know, every couple of days they download it, and so they can, so people who don't have one can see what this kit will do when they build it. And people who do have one can share what modifications they're making. And so along with the podcast, there's this little...
Yeah. Can we switch to the computer?
Okay.
So on the page that we have here...
It's just the podcast page on Libsyn. And, you know, so they send in, you know, pictures of their kids playing music. And so it's kind of an interesting way of using this as sort of a, you know, a documentation purpose.
Yeah, and so you upload the files, and then they can subscribe to them in iTunes.
Yeah.
And then...
It's kind of fun. They comment, and they ask, you know, how did you make that sound, and, you know, what kind of modifications have you made, and I think it's good to build a community of users, because, you know, hardware is
and
fun to build. And
you initially want... There was someone who made a Zox... Or, I'm sorry, a Roland 303... And they were going to sell it or something, and then they wouldn't show how they made it. Like, what you told me that the reason why you did this is because someone wouldn't give you the information. Like, how did it work out in the origin?
Well, there's other people who've made clones, but nobody open sourced it, and then they discontinued it, and so I couldn't make it. So I had to start from scratch and reverse engineer the original one.
And there was initially a kit, though, that someone was...
Yeah, there were kits, but, I mean, they were discontinued, so...
Okay, no one...
That's the problem with having things that aren't open source, is that they get discontinued, and then you can't get the information anymore.
So, the other thing that at Make and at Craft that we use iTunes for, and what we use podcasting for, or any RSS2 reader, is to distribute information in a slightly different way. How many of you guys know about the Make Weekend Project with Bree Fettis? Yeah? Yay, Bree! So we do a weekend project every week, and Bree, he's tried to go to space or something this week. I really don't know what Bree's up to half the time. But he sent a bunch of cameras in space, and we got weather issues. But every week we try to do a how-to. So one of them,
this is... reverse engineering of circuitry, maybe to identify a signal that you...
How to use an oscilloscope, really exciting stuff. But if you ever want to know how to use an oscilloscope, we show from start to finish how to use one. Now, that's great. We distribute it over all the ways you'd expect. And we also put out PDFs. And every volume of Make, we put PDFs in iTunes. And a lot of people don't know that you can attach... using enclosures and get them into iTunes. And one of the things that we thought would be interesting for 2006, and one of the things we're going to keep doing this year, is distribute PDFs that have 3D objects in them. And technically, we could bring these to... You could get a... print out the object. But let me show you one of the ones...
Well, there was, for Craft, there was the sewing pattern, so you could actually literally print out the PDF and start making, you know, there was like a tube top and there was a skirt or like shorts or something. So.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is the PDF format, it's an ISO standard now, so it's not closed, it's not, you know, entirely open, but it's a standard that a lot of people are using now. So this is one of the projects that we did. We made a gigantic spud gun, shoot potatoes, because it's a separate project we like. Yeah, and one of the interesting things that you can do with the documentation that we put out is learn how to build it, and this is all in 3D.
So it's like, that's like 8, right, Adobe Acrobat 8?
Yeah, actually from 7 forward, you can do it.
And you do the split apart?
Yeah, so it has explode, but not explode in the way you expect. And it comes apart, and you can you know, zoom in and zoom out. And, you know, we think that this is going to be a way that people start to distribute information. It's a great system. You can imagine getting this and sending it off to your 3D printer, and now you've got, you know, your spud gun or parts or the parts, some of the parts that you need. And then with Craft, our other magazine, we send out sewing patterns over iTunes, which is always fun to tell people. Like, oh, yeah, you can totally, like, build something after you subscribe to it. So we put these out, we're giving them away, and people are knitting and sewing and using these as the source for projects. So, you know, you do music, we have 3D stuff and do the videos. And then the other thing that we try to do with our videos is we're doing something a little different this year. And how many of you are trying to make money on your videos? Like vlog videos? Yeah, a couple? Yeah. Nobody. Everyone gave up.
Whoever?
Sorry. There's nothing to do with videos anymore. So this is one of our weekend projects that we did. And I'm not going to play it because it's really loud. But what we wanted to do is have one of our weekend projects with something to do at the end. So Bree will build a kit. He'll build an MP3 player. He'll build something that we actually sell in the Make store. So we tried to find someone to help monetize their videos, and it's kind of hard because, you know, we have how-to content. They're very popular, but what exactly, you know, fits with...
Well, I mean, you could try to have advertisements, or you could try to sort of do deals with companies that sell parts, or but it there's actually not that much money in it, and I think you guys tried Rever, but nothing, it didn't really work out as well, you know, as well.
Yeah, we only made a couple $100, like, every single time, even though the views were big.
Yeah.
They just didn't have a lot. So what we did is we worked with Blip TV, and we did something called DIY ads. So at the end of the video, after Bree finishes talking about the stuff, we made our own ad, and it actually has a button to say buy the kit.
Yeah, so, in Flash. So you can literally click it, and it goes straight to the store.
So after you're all excited about building this wacky contraption, hopefully this will work out. So.
Kit it on up, and then go ahead and put it up in a cool case and upload it to the Make Flickr pool. I really want to see these. Okay, I'm Bree Pettis for Make Magazine. Go forth, do some case mods, and have a great weekend.
I think it shows up.
Yay. Yeah. So, you know, simplest thing in the world, it has a buy now button. Because we have our own store, you're already into the shopping cart and you're doing stuff. So basically anyone can do this. They can put their T-shirts, they can put DVDs, they can put anything they want.
So this is a hardware kit that is open source hardware. And one of the problems with open source hardware is people are like, well, how do I get... how do I actually make it? And all this information is here, but I need to actually put it together. Yeah. And so having these videos, step-by-step instructions showing how you do it, and at the end, you press the button, and if you just want to take the shortcut to getting all the parts sent to you in the mail, you just spend a little bit of cash, and it's in your doorstep.
And then as far as the rest of the commerce piece goes, we put some of our things on Etsy now. And with Etsy, you can sell handmade goods. So people who assemble the kits and want to sell them on their own, if people don't want to build these, they just want to buy the finished thing, they can buy your Minty Booths on Etsy now.
Well, and that's part of why I said that my licensing allows commercial use, because I wanted to make sure that people could go ahead and make these and modify them and then sell them. Because they have a secondary market.
And one of your other projects, this is on a site called Instructables, which is collaborative, step-by-step learning, and it, their whole...
This is the user-generated content. This is, like, the best example of DIY.
Yeah, and this is another, like, physical instantiation of what you're saying, user-generated content. And so you've made a project called SpokePov that when you put it on your bicycle wheels, it makes little Pac-Man.
Yeah, when you bike around, and the LEDs spin around really fast, and it displays images, so... So then some people uploaded their own photos and, you know, some examples. And this site has step-by-step instructions, and it's really nice, and people can comment, and there's photo notes, and it's actually a really nice, easy way to get your project up and documented as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And you use photo notes not only on Instructables, but on your other projects.
Yeah, so I actually use Flickr. So before Instructables came around, Instructables was only a year or two old. Before that, as soon as I saw that you could do photo notes with Flickr, photo notes existed before Flickr, but that's how I got exposed to it. I was like, wow, this is perfect, because one of the problems with hardware is there's a lot of information, and you really want to be able to point to things because you can't, comment physical goods as well as you can software. So, you can do mouse overs and have parts. And you know, it's really easy. A lot of information is available using stuff like Flickr and photo notes and wikis and forums.
And forums you also have for all of your products. And you have unsupported projects that you put out once in a while, too.
Yes. Unfortunately, not all the projects I work on turn into kits. One of the projects that I worked on recently was an open-source cell phone jammer. And unfortunately, it's illegal in the U.S., for $10,000 up to a year in jail, to use...
Wait, it's illegal? He said I could use it all.
You're special. You know, it's one of the problems is that I can't tell kids of this, and so I had to do a really good job of documenting it, putting a lot of information out there so that people could, you know, make this device. And some people actually have. There's enough information that with a little bit of experience, you can actually go through the step-by-step instructions on the site, order the parts, order the circuit board, assemble it, and...
Yeah. And because it's an open source project, you can show how to make it.
Yes.
Can you carry it? But you, wait, how's it? Is it like, is it like drug laws? Or like, can you carry it there and you can transport it? You can't roll it. Like, what's the? How's it work? You can only show how to make it, right?
Yeah, basically the way the law, the FCC law is written, showing people how to make it or disseminating the information is totally okay. Actually building it and using it is not.
Okay. So that being said, you have a spectrum analyzer?
Oh yes, we do.
Okay. So we're gonna use one. there's two. This is the one that has big antennas.
So, let's see. Mm-hmm. So, okay. This is
that way.
The cell phone jammer. I don't smoke, so it's convenient.
Yeah.
But, so this is a device that was just on the screen.
When you put in cigarette packs, it's interesting because it's very offensive to have cigarettes. And, you know, you put it on the counter.
Yeah, especially like in New York or San Francisco, people are like, I can't believe you smoke. And you're like, yeah.
But meanwhile, the cell phones aren't working.
Yeah.
It's very quiet.
Well, another good benefit of using this enclosure is you can just kind of hold it like this, like kind of you can do weird things with it, and people don't get suspicious.
And so this does Wi-Fi, cell phone, Bluetooth, and GPS.
This one does GPS. That one we only set up to do cell phone or Wi-Fi.
So the things that people wear and like video game controllers, everything.
Yeah.
So if you can you turn on the camera?
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe talk a little bit about what that is.
Okay, so this is a spectrum analyzer. So this is a sort of expensive piece of equipment. And you can see this is showing all of the data that's being transmitted on the cell phone bands. And so this is 1.9 gigahertz. So if you have GSM, that's the frequencies. And so you can see that there's cell phone activity going on.
Yeah. And if we can switch to the computer real quick, what I wanted to do is... do something fun here. So we've all been in subways and or trains, and so go ahead and call me now.
Call now.
And I'll show you what happens.
Can you switch to this?
So that's the phone number. Okay.
So we'll switch to showing the spectrum analyzer.
Go ahead and go to the spectrum analyzer now.
So now I'm going to ringing. So you turn this on. And it'll take a second. And there you go. You can see how all of that data just got blocked. And
So my call got dropped.
It happens. Bad reception in here. So, you know, this is...
Yeah.
So this is sort of an example of, you know, sort of DIY technology in use. So we'll just leave it here. So we also do, you know, Wi-Fi as well. The Wi-Fi works a little better because Wi-Fi is not as powerful...
Yeah.
Protocol.
I've heard if like a Starbucks is crowded and everyone's on computers
or a cafe
for a long time,
and like people won't get up and leave.
I've heard that you can use one of these and people eventually.
People have been posting on the forums about this.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know.
People built these?
Uncorroborated. I don't know.
People have built these.
Yes, at least one person has documented. I saw photos and he's like, I built this. Works great. 10-foot range. He didn't. When he published it on his blog, he didn't call it a cell phone jammer. He called it like a RF test equipment. I know he had some name for it because he was a little scared. But I was like, I've seen that thing before.
If we could switch to the computer real quick. I don't know if this is going to turn out. But if you look at the top of my phone, the it's a Windows mobile phone, so it completely freaks out. There's like little pieces of UI everywhere, but the signal is dead and gone, and the phone crashed a little bit.
Yeah.
But... So, and as far as...
10-foot, 15-foot range. That one with external antennas is a lot better because it's got these big antennas in it.
And as far as the usage for this, it starts conversations. You're not malicious. You don't want to hurt people.
No.
But it starts a conversation about... Because this is only 5 feet. It could be a lot larger, but this is only around your...
10 feet, yeah.
So people want to use these. There was a study or something I remember you referenced that what... Do people hate the most?
There was a small study that the Lemelson group at MIT did, and they asked people what was the most hated technology that you use on a daily basis, and they said cell phones. But I think that, you know, again, and I worked on this at the Media Lab, and so I actually had to demo to a lot of companies, and one of the funniest things was that, remember the Samsung employee came up to me, and he said, This is really interesting. Is there a way for me to put this in our phones so it'll block other people's phones, but not Samsung phones or something?
Yeah. Those guys are like reptiles.
I think so. They're, yeah.
They're like, how can I kill the Sony phone?
Yeah, yeah. It was really interesting. Yeah. I was trying to explain to them it's illegal, it's like artwork. But
they didn't even care. They're just like, we can get lobbyists.
But I think that one of the... I think one of the promises of this open source hardware movement is that people can design stuff that, I mean, this is illegal in some countries, not in the U.S., but you can talk about this information and learn about it. And there's some elements of this design that are useful if you're designing cell phones. Yeah. I mean, it uses many of the same...
And if you're paranoid, tinfoil hat guy, you can, like, make this so you can stop GPS. Is that the government putting it in your
phone? One guy wanted to use this to... He said he was afraid of bugs in his house, like... Not insects, but, like, people, like, the FBI tapping him, so he wanted to use this, and he wanted to build it.
Yeah, because the FBI bugged them. Probably. They probably did.
Who knows?
And then citywide Wi-Fi is a new kind of debate, whether, like, you can where can you turn it off? And
right. Maybe you don't want to have citywide Wi-Fi. Maybe you want to not have... It's interesting that you can own property, but you don't own...
The airwave
inside. So if you're like, I don't want citywide Wi-Fi in here, I don't want people using Wi-Fi in my store or, in my school, you can, turn this off.
Okay. Well, this is probably a good time to break for questions because everyone always asks about, that
stuff.
Particular project. And if you guys want to learn how to build your own, of course, everything's online. But I think they have microphones on each side. And I know there's some events coming up in Austin. If folks are from Austin, there's a Maker Faire coming up in October.
Yeah, I'll be there.
And you'll be there. And we've been known to show people how to build things
more,
like this.
Yeah, more in-depth. You get to play the press the button, look at the spectrum analyzer up close.
Okay, so there's a fellow at the microphone over there.
Hi, I was just wondering if you're beginning to see any issues around owners of these devices pursuing people who... break the firmware and publish how-tos on the firmware? I mean, other than sort of Hollywood DVD encryption, are you seeing more cases like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, sometimes. It's interesting. It seems like there are companies that will go after people initially. There was a guy who did a ton of work with the Sony Aibo, and right away Sony shut him down, and then they kind of made a deal, and then the site was okay. And so I think initially companies... They don't like when people are hacking firmware, and they don't like when people are doing things. But when there's enough movement behind it, and people do stuff, like Apple doesn't seem to care about the iPod Linux thing. I presented at Macworld about iPod Linux, and there was some uncomfortable stuff. But Apple employees later were like, "That's really cool. I have Ogg Vorbis files. I finally, I wanted to play it." So, and they like it when you can change the firmware and do the graphics. So I think there's a little bit of if we don't look at it, we don't know about it. So I think there's don't hack, don't tell, or policy or something. I don't know what they call it.
To the extent that that's true, we're sort of depending on the generosity of companies not to sue us.
Well, they can try. I mean, if you see what happened, I hate to pick on Sony because they seem to have a weird policy with sending out malware CDs and then doing things like the PSP. They constantly tried to change it. They can try all they want, but people really want to do things with their technology and bend it the way they want to. So I actually don't think you can stop it, at this point. There's wikis and Flickr and everything that we show. We want to have examples of, here's where all the information can go, and you really can't stop. It's like trying to stop a video on YouTube. You can try, but, you press it down here, and then it, pops up over here. So, and then DRM, obviously, didn't work. There's talks and there's software that break every form of DRM already on DVDs. One of the, articles that you search for DVD iPod, every website has an article on how to break it. I used to think, I was like, oh my God, we're going to get an email one day from someone. No, never. They just, they don't want to have a test case, I think, because it's fair use. You can put CDs in iTunes. You can't put DVDs in iTunes, even though the thing plays video. It's ridiculous. So I kind of, I hope they try to stop it, because we get a test case. And I think then we'd be able to say definitely 100%, you can put something you own on something else you own. But I don't know. I was like, yay. So, over there.
Yeah, I was wondering, have you guys looked at that Craftsman CNC thing? That's like a wood mill?
Yeah, I saw it,
yeah. Yeah, there's a couple people who bought them, and we asked them to do a review on Make. It's the one that's from Sears, right?
Yeah.
Sears is selling a 3D carver now. It's awesome. Who would have thought? Sears,
Yeah, it's a CNC machine, but just for wood. It doesn't do metal and stuff like that.
Not yet.
It's $1,000 though.
Yeah. So if you go online, type Sears, Craftsman, CNC. If you go on Make, you'll see it, and you can put in your 3D objects, and it'll carve it out of wood. All right. Any more questions?
Oh, yeah. I think
we wrapped up. Oh, she's saying we have a couple more minutes. Okay, is there any more questions?
Oh, we have to sing and dance now.
No. Who's going to crack the what? The iPod? The gigantic... Oh, the iPod. Well, it is. I mean, you can put Linux on it now. You can pretty much do more with it than before. So that's the fun project. If you have an old iPod sitting in your drawer, which we all do, because we all have to buy a new one every 6 months, I think. It's the law or something, I get passed. So once you have one, don't throw it away. You can put a new battery in. You can put a new hard drive in, and you can also you can finally buy games on, like, I don't use regular iPod. I use Linux iPod. But I heard you can buy games and iTunes now on your iPod. But all the games that you want to play, you can already get for free with iPod Linux. So it's technically cracked. Last week, the 5.5G iPod, which is one with a screen and color, there's like different variations, that got cracked or owned or whatever you want to call it. And you can do stuff with it. So, you know, the most popular music player is still open enough for people like us, and no one seems to be stopping it. You go to iPodLinux.org. You know, there's a website, and you can pretty much download anything. It's a one-click installer. It's a lot of fun. It's like, all of a sudden, it's like, I can dual boot new Linux. Neat. So I can, like, use terminal with a scroll wheel. But, are there?
Yeah, I was just wondering, is your name Lemore?
Lemore.
Lemore. Are you still at MIT, or how long have you been?
No, I graduated.
So what do you do now, I mean, to make a living? Because whenever I hear presentations about open source stuff, I always wonder, do you feel like the clock's ticking and sooner or later you're going to be seduced into some job where you're reverse engineering something to make somebody else rich? Or do you feel like this is really a lifestyle choice where
whatever you do
is going to be sort of for the liberation and betterment of
society? It's hard to explain to my parents this lifestyle choice. it's interesting because people say, like, where is the business of this? And we're talking about that laser business, and we have people come and tattoo their computers.
We charge $100 for a laptop. That's funny.
I actually do sell kits, and there's enough demand. I mean, even though I open source everything, and you can make anything in my store on your own, I sell kits, and the kit's like $20 or $40. Yeah. And, you know, I work it out so it makes sense for me. But it's a reasonable price. And, yeah, a lot of people want to skip that step of ordering all the parts from different places and having them shipped to them. So that's the business I run.
So to answer the question, too, is 100% of your income from open source hardware?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So you make a living and you have employees and you do stuff. So you can, you know, you can mess around with this stuff and make a living. You also sell, so you have the Mickey Biz thing. You have this one that you turn on. And if the lights are off, when you wave this, it spells words. So you can.
And there's a synthesizer. A lot of people want to buy the synthesizer. There's a lot of parts. And, you know, the custom panels are expensive to get one made, but I make 100 at a time. So, you know, I sell that to people who, or other people make it without buying the kit, but it's a lot easier just to buy the kit.
I think one of the interesting things is I work with a lot of kit makers at Make is, and they essentially give away open source stuff. They're like, here, take this. But the difference between open source software and the open source hardware is a lot of people want to buy the physical thing. They want to buy the kit to assemble themselves. And so there is a business model behind this. They're like, oh, I can take the recipe, and then I can build it. And because you're buying thousands of parts at a time, you and all the other kit makers, you can do it for $20, and $20 is nothing. It's like Starbucks.
And what's really nice is that I know a lot of people who do electronics, and they want to design stuff, and they end up trying to go to manufacture it in China, and it's a real pain. And I don't know if you've ever tried to do this, but it's like you have to actually go to Hong Kong and Shenzhen. You have to hang out there and watch them do it. And before you know it, you spend $100,000 just getting this thing that you want to make.
That's probably wrong the first time.
Huh?
That's probably wrong.
And it's wrong the first time, and you have to do updates. And when you do hardware and open source hardware, you've got all these users helping you, and you've got like a really great, beta kit collection or a beta test collection, and it's really easy because you're doing it on a smaller scale to quickly update and add these new functions that people have been contributing to your open source hardware project. So I suggest it to a lot of my friends, and I've seen more people start to, you know, create businesses around open source hardware. So it makes more sense. Seriously, what does Red Hat Linux do? I don't quite know what the company provides for me. I mean, I'll just download the ISO. Yeah, you can buy it, and it's one of the models for Linux, but the support makes more sense when there's physical stuff than when there's software, in my opinion.
Next question?
Yeah, I have a question. Are you seeing any movement to open source or sort of tinkering in other sciences? So this is electronics and obviously in software, but are you seeing it increasingly in chemistry or in biology or in other, other areas?
Yeah, I'm really focused on electronics, so I'm
obviously,
kind of narrow. But there was that, who was that doctor who, the biochemist who released the method for making
Tamiflu?
The Tamiflu.
Yeah, so it's happening. What the problem right now is the getting the stuff around the world to developing countries is hard, but if you can get them the recipes and how to actually do it, you have a shot. One of my favorite projects is a doctor who made a baby warmer. So the mortality rate was awful. Kids are dying. They just needed to be warmed up. And these baby warmers in the U.S. have to be FDA approved, and they have to be, you know, it takes a lot of time. So this doctor basically made like a light bulb on a dimmer switch, and it's a baby warmer. So it cut the mortality rate in half. So they're sharing that. That's like an open source project, and that's like just-in-time learning. Oh, well, I was saying something.
The night lab, I didn't like to use the open source bioengineering for the, like,
Okay. You know, biochemistry, genetics,
so it's happening.
They're sharing a lot of information and sharing code to process that information. So absolutely.
I personally think that's where it's going to head, because the rest of the world isn't going to probably abide by the way our rules and the way we do medical stuff, because it's, I mean, we don't even have universal health care here. So I think they're going to be like, you know what, we're going to do Tamiflu on our own. Like, we'll sell it to you guys. So I think we're going to see that happen eventually. But I think these electronics projects is the first step to getting there. Like, even though they're like USB chargers and toys and everything, you can imagine there's an open source EKG project right now. There's an open source, there's like millions of little tiny brains going on these little, they're like, oh my God, I need to work on this medical thing, and they're releasing it out. We have one of these one laptop for child laptops that we're taking apart, and you know, we're going to put content on this, and it'll probably be things that are helpful, but at the same time, this is a great way to share information. So we'll see what happens when these get in the hands of developing countries and there's things that they can do and build. Next question?
For wireless hackers who are software people rather than hardware people, there's a neat platform out now. It's the Nokia N800 tablet,
yeah,
which is Nokia is supporting a device that runs Linux, and they're really supporting the developer community. I don't work for them. I'm not shilling them. I'm just interested in this. It's kind of an example of a big company encouraging people to hack this device that they're selling at CompUSA, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, the Nokia 770 was the first one they did, and I was tinkering around with that. And it's neat because it's like there was a couple things I didn't like with it. I'm like, oh, right, I can't really complain. I can just fix it.
That's right. Like, unlike the Sony devices in the same space where you can't, they make it hard to change it, so it's exactly what you buy. These devices, you know, if it's not what you want, you know, in a week or two, someone else is going to come out with an application for it. So it's really nice.
Yeah, consumer electronic companies, like every gadget site in the world, if you read the comments, they pretty much say exactly what every company needs to do. So it's like, they say, like, here's exactly what you need to do to fix your broken thing. So having open source, listening to that community, I think is always helpful. And I think Nokia is going to end up having something more interesting now than if they just, you know, kept it as a device closed up. Next.
Hello. I thought I'd put in a little historical observation. This idea of corporate closedness in terms of technology is new. If you look inside an Apple IIe distribution, you will see a listing of all the source code of the ROM in it. If you look at old stereos, they came with a complete schematic. So this terror of releasing your schematics and releasing your source code is actually new, and I don't know the source of it, but since you made the observation that you had never seen a company release these things, that, I guess, just shows that we have a different perspective. And I just think it's interesting. If you have any comment, go ahead.
No, absolutely. I mean, I remember the Commodore 64 had schematics, and the disk drive had instructions on how you could repair it because it was going to break after every 3 months.
Yeah.
So you'd have to go in and open it up and fix it. So I think they did it from the sort of repair point of view, and people don't repair stuff as much. But, I mean, I think a lot of different things came together to kind of, not force, but suggest these companies it would be a good idea to not release. You know, they're more scared of, you know, Chinese rip-offs or something.
Yeah. I blame the 80s. Like, nothing good came out of the 80s.
It's 80s fault.
Like, can we just write that off?
Decade. or, you know, the fact that people don't repair stuff as much, it's just cheaper to replace it.
Yeah.
A lot of things came together to kind of lead to this, you know, less documentation, more use it once, throw it away.
I think we'll see it more. I mean, look, we mentioned the Roomba. It's the most successful domestic robot in history, and you can hack it. I don't know if there's some robot plan to take over or something, but I think it's cool
that... floor up.
Yeah, I mean, if you buy a robot vacuum that vacuums your house, you should be able to, like, control it, worst case, you know.
Yeah, they might rise up against us.
Yeah. Next question?
Hi. I don't know if you mentioned this earlier, but I'm interested in that laptop that's in your hand, and I wonder if there's a way developers can get their hands on them to design
for
them.
Yeah, olpc.org. I think has a wiki for developers, but you can also, if you want to check it out while you're here, you can play around with it. And I just had to beg them and tell them that I would put good content in, and I didn't really tell them I was going to take it apart, but I think they'll be okay with it.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and then is it true that you can buy one, and when you buy one, they create
another one?
Well, what's going to happen is when these get out in the world, like, you know, someone's going to do the 419 scam and be like, I have greetings and salutations. I am Charles Taylor. I will bring you greetings and OLPCs. Just wire me $500 from your Western Union. So there's always that. Probably a bad idea.
There's a fellow over there.
Over there?
About education, like elementary, high school education. I've been following stuff like in the Lego Mindstorms community and how you can get kids interested in science and math at an early age. I'm wondering if you have anything to share about that.
Yeah, not quite yet. I'm starting to work more with, you know, high school teachers and trying to get them kits so they can build it. But I don't. Unfortunately, Lego Mindstorms showed up after I graduated high school, so I don't know exactly what they're doing these days with robotics education. And I mean, they're first, and that's sort of kind of taken over science education for kids.
Well, at Make, we do we're always asked, like, oh, could you make for kids? If you look at Make, it kind of is for kids. And a lot of people use it as course curriculum. And each volume of Make, I think there's, like, you know, 20 great projects that you can probably do with the kits. As teachers are starting to use it as curriculum. People make your USB charger kits, and they send pictures of their, like, daughter making the kit and, like, all these things. And so I actually think for instructional learning, Instructables has some neat projects. You can kind of slice and dice articles out of Make, but like I said, a lot of them are totally appropriate now. And then every year we do the Crazy Maker Fair that has, you know, tens of thousands of people. And it's probably going to be more like a field trip eventually, where it's a science fair on steroids, where people go and learn how to build all these things. So I think the hands-on learning is where it's going to go towards. And building a kit is great, because when you're done, you have a thing. And soldering actually isn't that hard. And, you know, younger kids can solder. You just need to have adults around. So I think that's where it's heading. So we'll see. We're trying our best. All right.
Are we done?
I think, are we out of time? Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks.